Okay. Shoot. Okay, I won't. I'll try to speak for only another 20 minutes, so don't worry. Won't go on forever to give enough time for discussion. I want to sort of change the tack a little bit and say something about the professional training of academics, because given the context in which you guys are here, and it kind of in a way was made very clear to me in the introduction, that we don't really train people to be academics in a serious fashion. I mean, what we do, of course, is we train people how to do research, but what we don't do, I mean, sometimes maybe you guys do, but we certainly don't train people how to teach. We put people in the classroom and tell them to teach, but we don't actually train them how to teach. We are now beginning to require a kind of certification for teaching, which requires that you go to a few seminars from people who supposedly know how to teach, teaching you how to teach, but it's a very limited kind of thing. And then you get a little certificate that you can put on your CV. But generally speaking, you know, if you're training to be a PhD, and again, I think this is something that has not changed very much since the time I was doing a PhD, even though all the other stuff about political economy has changed in the world since then. But this part hasn't changed. Namely, I think what you think your training primarily is has to do with research, right? Being able to work in the area you're working in, being recognized by your peers who work in that area, being able to publish articles, being able to deliver papers that are accepted by your peers, and that insofar as that's achieved, you've been trained. And then teaching is seen, well, when you're a graduate student, teaching is seen as basically just a way to earn income, and indeed is sort of seen as something that might even be a bit competitive with your research. In other words, I have to waste time marking papers and talking to those idiot students in the classroom, whereas I could be, you know, in the library thinking my great thoughts or writing my papers. I'm assuming that that's what you would be doing otherwise. And it seems to me that this is really bad, right? I mean, it seems to me this is quite bad. I think it's very pervasive. In fact, I remember in graduate school, I was actually given the advice, don't worry too much about teaching. In other words, as long as the students don't complain, and as long as your student evaluations don't get too low, right? Don't feel you've got to put a lot of effort into this. What's important is that you get your PhD done, and that, you know, it's done in the best possible way so that you can then get a good job and all the rest of it. Okay, I think that's kind of, certainly that was the message I was sent when I was a PhD student. I don't think that's changed very much. And certainly nothing about the professional training of academics would lead you to think otherwise, actually. The other thing, of course, too, is that, when we talk about being professional academics, you would have thought that one of the things one might learn in the process would be something about the history of the university, given that an academic is someone whose job is primarily oriented toward the university. But of course, that's not there either, at least not in my experience. I don't think that's ever required. So there's a sense in which, while we call it academic professional training, what we're really talking about is training to be a researcher in a field. And in a sense, where you actually do that is not really of concern in the professional training. I mean, there's an assumption it would be a university, but there's nothing that you need to learn about the nature of a university that seems to be important. Okay? And maybe a course like this is supposed to remedy this problem.
Yes.
Yes. I understand. I understand. I understand. So I understand that. But I'm just saying how unusual that is, okay?
It's great.
Yeah. So this is a very kind of, you know, in comparison to other kinds of fields where we talk about professional training, this is quite interesting. Just how little of the actual profession that you're supposedly trying to go into you actually learn anything about. Okay? And so it's perhaps not surprising that academics do not know how to manage their situation very well when they're put in a changing environment because they've never really been taught quite properly how to be an academic. They've been told how to be a researcher in a particular field, but they've never been told how to be an academic. Okay? Now, this kind of issue, in terms of my experience, one area where this kind of issue really comes to the fore, and in a way, I mentioned a little bit about it earlier with regard to journalism, is the role of the academic as an intellectual. Some of you may know I wrote a book called The Intellectual, which is kind of like a Machiavelli's Prince-style book about the intellectual, you might say. It's a kind of how-to thing, how to be good at it, that kind of thing. And I've also written a book, I guess it was put on this reading list, The Sociology of Intellectual Life. And the thing that I would say here is I think it is very arrogant for academics to think that they're intellectual simply by virtue of being academics. Because the kind of professional training academics get does not necessarily equip them to be intellectuals. And I think the difficulty with which academics deal with the media is symptomatic of this problem. Okay, what do I mean? I mean, when you get academics who say, I can't do a 30-second soundbite on something, you know, or I can't do a 750-word article in a newspaper because what I'm working on is just so deep and complex and, you know, and these journalists, all they want to do is simplify everything to kind of, you know, earn money in the marketplace and, you know, and satisfy idiots and all of this, right? And you're familiar with this kind of line, right? And it's one of the ways in which academics kind of draw a distinction between themselves and journalists. But in a sense, when they do that, they betray a couple of things. The first thing they betray is the fact that, again, what are academics primarily trained to do? It's to do research and to deal with other, which is to say, to deal with other people working in the same areas they've been working in. So in other words, when they're taken outside their linguistic comfort zone, when they're no longer in the mode of their jargon, right, or where they can presuppose quite a lot of knowledge on the part of the person they're talking to, they're hopeless. Okay? So there's a sense almost in which what we call the professional training of academic, it's kind of like a trained incapacity. You become a bit dumber when you get your PhD, because what happens is that, you know, you actually become, it actually makes it very difficult for you to communicate because you're constantly feeling, you know, that you're not actually doing justice to what you're talking about. So you become self-incapacitating in some way. And then this strangely becomes a kind of mark of integrity, right? I refuse to self-vulgarize, right? I'd rather not talk to anyone at all than to vulgarize what I'm doing. Right? Academics have a lot of this, right? And this becomes then the badge of professionalism. Okay? Now, maybe this works to a certain extent, because it is certainly true, if you look at the sociology of professions, that a lot of the authority that professions often have has to do with the kind of impenetrability of jargon, right? And the inability of other people to understand what you're saying. And so as a result, you just have to trust what the, you know, like a medical doctor is a great example, or lawyers, right? You don't know what the hell these guys are talking about, but they have your best interest in mind, so you trust what they say. And you say, they're very smart people, but I can't quite get what they're going after. And academics trade on that as well, it seems to me, okay? Now this seems to be, you know, really kind of unfortunate, but one of the consequences of it is it's very difficult for academics, if they're going to engage in that game, to then claim they're intellectuals. Okay? Because at the end of the day, being an intellectual is about dealing in ideas. And I think you got to think about what an idea is here. Maybe Platonic is too strong a word, but the point that I would want to get across by emphasizing Platonic is the idea that if you really have an idea, it can be realized in many different media. In other words, the idea, if it is an idea, is not so tied to just one medium and one mode of expression that if you cannot express yourself that way, you cannot get your point across. Okay? Now, academics, in principle, should be able to be intellectuals, precisely because the teaching environment and the research environment are really quite radically different communicative situations, right? The research environment demands that you actually, you know, speak to people who already know stuff, and so you're operating at a certain register there. But when you're dealing with students in the classroom, you do not presuppose anything of the sort, right? And you actually want them to learn this stuff. So in some sense, you have to start from the assumption of what they need to know in order to get to what where you want them to be. So you actually have to do quite a lot of work, in a sense. And so ideally, right, ideally, you could become an intellectual by being an academic because of these different communicative contexts. The problem is that we denigrate the teaching context too much. And of course, if the students don't come in thinking they're going to get any ideas from you, right, you can just basically just give them a watered down version of how you talk about your research, right? Or talk, you know, in other words, remain at that level of sort of academic abstraction and then just figure the students will get what they need to know from reading the books assigned or something of that kind. In other words, there is no specific form of translation that's necessary in order to get the idea across. And of course, if the students don't expect much from you, right, then you're not under any pressure. Right? And indeed, because you have the students as a kind of captive audience, because they're forced to take your class in order to get their degree, right, they have no choice. You know, how, you know, this is where I think things like student evaluations could do some good. Because if students, you know, the problem is whether a student knows how to assess an academic properly in the classroom, that's a problem. But in principle, if they did know how to assess an academic in the classroom, that would be actually quite a good accountability strategy to see whether, in fact, the academic is acting in a proper intellectual manner, being able to get the ideas across, being able to make them alive and vivid and so forth. And so from that standpoint, student evaluations could perform an enormous role, enormously positive role in making academics intellectuals, because you might think of, in that case, of the classroom as kind of like a miniature version of a media audience, right? Where you're making your pitch, you know, on radio, television, whatever. Okay? So I do think that that's kind of a, you know, but there seems to be very little incentive within academic culture to actually move in this direction. Okay? Moreover, when people do move in this direction, and that is to say academics who have the capacity to be intellectuals and are able to operate in multiple media and stuff like this, academics typically trash them. Okay? I mean, this is the other thing too. You know, not only is it not recognized, it's actually devalued. Okay? And so, I mean, I'm sure it's true in this country, but of course, in, you know, all over the world, there are these kind of media academics, as it were. Right? These are guys, you know, who on writing the newspapers or on TV, radio, whatever, and they're actually very intelligent people and you know, people from great backgrounds and things like this, and you know, but they choose to communicate that way, to get the big audiences, right? And to have kind of a, you know, kind of a kind of bigger impact, at least in the short term. And this kind of behavior is denigrated by academics typically. And it's certainly impossible to actually get academic accreditation this way. Okay? I mean, it's very interesting in this regard, right? Because, you know, if you look at somebody like Richard Dawkins in the UK, okay? Now, Richard Dawkins, a very controversial guy whose views I do not necessarily agree with, but he is actually an intellectual. He is a real intellectual, this guy. Okay? This is a guy who does the business really well. He can do anything. He can be in any medium, and he can make his point, and he can get the people to respond. And of course, people misunderstand what he says. And of course, he is forced to kind of put things in very kind of black and white terms when things are really more nuanced. Of course, all that's true, right? But the point is, when you're in that kind of intellectual environment, a big part of what you're trying to do is to get the discussion going. Right? And so it becomes important then what you're doing is not delivering a kind of dogmatic statement, you know, I have now nailed it down once and for all. You know, because research often has this kind of character to it, right? Where people are always keen on, writing the definitive work on something. Now, what does the definitive work on something mean? It means you shut everybody else up. right? No one's going to, you've nailed this. No one's going to touch this again. They're just going to cite you when they want to talk about it, right? This is considered to be nirvana for researchers, right? Where you've nailed something down so well that whenever anyone wants to talk about it, they have to cite you, okay? You've produced a kind of building block of knowledge, solid stuff, right? But this goes completely against the whole spirit of engaging in intellectual life, right? Which is a much more fluid thing, which is much more actually about encouraging disagreement, right? Encouraging change of mind, all of this kind of stuff. And look, this idea is very much part also of the academic culture, okay? And very much historically a part of the teaching culture, all right? And certainly, and this is, you guys are humanists. This should appeal to you. When the modern university, Humboldt, back in the early 19th century, it was based on the humanities, okay? And it was about liberal education. Liberal education was not about teaching a bunch of facts, right? And research and all of that in the sense that we understand it today, right? It wasn't about that, right? It was basically about you should learn disciplines, but in you might say, the old medieval sense of discipline as a mode of self-transformation, right? When you undertake a discipline, like a monastic discipline, right, in the Middle Ages, something like that. That was the spirit in which you would undertake a discipline, right? And so, you would learn a lot of stuff, right? So you'd learn philosophy, let's say, right? But what was important wasn't for you to kind of like know the difference between the empiricists and the rationalists and, all these distinctions within the history of philosophy. What was important is you learn how to philosophize, right? And that the reason why you'd read the philosophers was to pick up the activity, right? And the activity could then be part of your sort of repertoire as you develop into a human being, into a person. This is what Bildung, right? Bildung in the German tradition was about, right? And that was the spirit in which teaching took place, right? And so the reason why you went to a classroom wasn't to get facts. You'd get facts from books and things like that. When you went to the classroom, it was actually to hear the lecturer, because the lecturer supposedly exemplified in their person what you could do too yourself through internalizing this stuff. So it is about personal self-transformation, and the teacher is needed to enact that, right? That's the point. Not as an imparter of data, not as an imparter of facts, not someone who comes in there as an authority. Look, you, I've established this. This is on the exam. Shut up. This is not the way to go. This is not teaching. Okay? And so I do think that this is, this is this side of the intellectual side of academia is completely lost, even though if you go to the founding of the modern university with Humboldt, right? Because remember, what Humboldt was trying to do in establishing this kind of university about the unity of teaching and research and all these wonderful classical values that we still at least pay lip service to, right? He was trying to bring the Enlightenment. He was trying to institutionalize the Enlightenment. That was basically what he was trying to do. Because all of those intellectuals of the Enlightenment, the Voltaires, the Rousseaus, the Diderots, all those guys in the 18th century, they existed outside the university. They hated the university. They thought the university was just full of dogma and authority, and they were holding back the progress of knowledge. And Humboldt basically said, they had a point. And so then it becomes important, insofar as the universities are the vehicle through which the next generation is being reproduced and the way in which society is taken forward into the future, that it becomes important that these progressive spirits of the Enlightenment actually be institutionalized in some way, and that was what the Humboldtian University was about, okay? He's inspired by Kant. Kant already is making noises in this direction because Kant doesn't like the way universities are organized either. If you read his Contest of the Faculties essay, you'll see that. And so Humboldt actually makes this thing come alive. But the point is that what the academic is doing in the classroom is Enlightenment. Right, he's exemplifying Enlightenment. That's what he's trying to do. And the way he enlightens you is not by telling you things you didn't know, but by exemplifying a certain kind of person who is open to new things, who is open to the truth, who's open-minded. That is the thing you're exemplifying in your practice in the classroom. And that is not something reducible to just repeating the research you've done. Right? It's a much more dramatic thing. It's much more like theater. Right? I mean, and I think that this is, this is where you see, There's some interesting. I forgot who did the painting, but there's a very famous painting of Schelling. As you know, Schelling was rector of the University of Berlin as well. He was one of the German idealists alongside of Hegel and Fichte. You may know these guys, right? Okay, so Schelling was the rector of the University of Berlin. And there's a very famous painting of him where he's addressing a kind of amphitheater-style lecture hall. And he's just there declaiming, you know? And everybody's just in rapt attention at this guy. And it's really striking. Because the thing, of course, about these guys from the early years of the modern university, the German idealists, is, of course, these are very difficult guys to read. These are not guys who, you know, you read this stuff, it's just like impenetrable, right? But somehow these people were very animated presences. They saw real, that you had to do both things, and they were different things to do, okay? And I think this whole Enlightenment side of the university has been lost. And so as a result, it becomes very easy for people to think that the university is replaceable, right? We don't need people giving lectures. We can just, you know, we can just download stuff, right? We can just engage in video games or something with the text that we need to read. And once we've mastered them sufficiently, we get a little tick box or something, right? We don't need to ever go to lectures anymore, right? I mean, and I think, and the big problem with this is that the people who should be giving the lectures kind of like this too. Right? Because lecturing is an incredibly unpopular task in universities among academics. Right? They think they have an ungrateful audience and they don't feel like talking to them. And so always excuses get made for not having to have lectures. Okay? But nevertheless, this is actually where the soul of the university is conveyed in a public way. This is how people see what an academic is as an intellectual on a regular basis is in the lecture. That's the only place. Okay? And that is irreplaceable. And as soon as you get rid of the lecture and, you know, the need for good lectures that actually grip people, you're basically going to eliminate the role of the academic as a kind of, as a recognizable social role. Right? Because we have lots of researchers around. There are researchers in all kinds of fields. Market researchers, right? You know, researchers working, you know, in science parks, you know, doing stuff for R&D divisions, right? There's researchers all over the place. But what makes them an academic? You know, what's the difference? Right? It's actually what happens in the classroom that makes the difference. Okay? So I do think, and you know, as I've been pointing out throughout, we actually don't prepare people for this. We actually discourage them from taking this too seriously. We certainly don't reward people for this. But nevertheless, I do think, again, thinking in terms of how do you brand the university? How do you brand the academic, right, as a distinct role in society? This is the way to do it. And this was, in fact, the original idea of Humboldt, you know, in the early 19th century. Okay, so what I'm talking about is about reinventing this kind of classical model. And I'll stop here so we can have some time for some discussion. No, I see you looking at the watch.
I'm checking. I'm supposed to keep track.
I know, I understand. No, I appreciate that.
Are you finished?
I'm finished, yeah. No, I deliberately am stopping here.
You can finish anywhere.
Yeah. No, but I'm finishing here, yeah. So I don't start a new topic.
No, thanks a lot. I'm sure there will be new topics cropping up here. I don't know if there's a need to keep to any of the preparations you've made, because I'm not sure exactly how you've gone about doing it, or if we should just open the discussion in a general sense. What do you think?
Yeah, that's fine.
The general discussion is fine?
Yeah.
Then I invite you to say okay. Anything.
Yeah, I have just I thought about the question about autonomy and wanted to discuss what is the difference between a company paying for certain research to be made and a student paying for an education and changing the education from within by going to certain kind of lectures that become more popular and by influencing the content by showing what they want to know.
Well, I actually, what you've described about the student doesn't bother me at all, okay? I mean, I'm not sure what is the kind of comparison you're making with the in the first instance with the research coming from a company. I didn't quite get what is the comparison you're trying to make.
Are trying to pay for certain kind of research to benefit them, and the students are influencing the education from within.
Oh, because okay. Well, I think this has a lot to do with how one. I think there is a difference. At least this is the way I would understand the difference. I think the corporation already comes up with a fairly set, you might say, a set range of goals that it's trying to achieve, right? And the research that they're commissioning fits into that. Okay, so in other words, I don't think the corporation is engaged in any process of self-transformation, right? It's basically just purchasing a particular thing that will fit to help the company make money. And so, whereas I think in the case of the student, what you've described, and I think this is in the spirit of the original university, is you start with the assumption the student is kind of unformed, right? The student pays X number of dollars to go to university, but what he's paying for is a kind of opportunity of self-exploration that will involve choosing certain courses over others, you know, and as a result, certain professors may turn out to be more popular than others through all these choices that are being made. But the student doesn't actually come in with a set agenda necessarily. At least that should be the idea. I mean, that's why it's really important, by the way, that universities should not be oversold as places to get credentials for jobs. Because what that does then is it shuts down this possibility for self-transformation. Because if the student comes in thinking, okay, the reason why I'm in a university is to get a credential to get this job, then that'll channel how they think about the value of all the courses even before they've had a chance to experience them. You see? And so that's why I think the key thing here, you know, isn't the amount of money the student's paying, but the frame of mind in which the student enters into the matter. You see? And I think there, you know, you need the... And so I like the idea of students actually choosing a lot of stuff, you know, being able to choose. That's fine, right? Lots of students choose lots of things, and that may end up making certain classes more popular than others and all of that. But I think that that's okay. That's okay in principle. What is worse is if the students come in thinking, you know, I'm in this university just to get this degree to get a job.
You heard about the Bologna process?
Oh, sure, of course. Yes, I know. I know, that kills the whole process. Yeah.
It's a pretty forceful statement to students that's how they're supposed to think.
I know. So. No, that undermines the whole... Because, see, here's the point. I think the issue here is, of course, we now live in a system of higher education where we're in a sense, we may have too many universities if we actually want universities to do what I'm talking about. And that maybe a lot of these other things that are called, and that's what I think the Bologna process is responding to, namely that if you look at all the things called universities across Europe, okay, you will see that maybe even most of them, you know, if they're doing anything any good, it's probably helping people get jobs, you know, and then in a sense, perhaps they should be allowed to do that. But then calling that a university and making that into the mission of the university is really to confuse institutional structures and institutional modes. And that's why it's going to take a certain amount of courage, but I think it's going to be necessary for academic leaders to say, we have too many universities. You know? And this is not so much, to be honest with you, I don't think this is so much an issue about funding. I think this is an issue about signaling about expectations of people entering into the institution. In other words, I have no, if we took 3/4 of all the things called universities now and we say they're really vocational training, that's really what they're about, and you give them some polytechnics, whatever you want to call them, right? You know, give them some dignified name, okay? I'd have no money, I have no problem putting money into those things, okay? But the key thing is that people, you know, students entering these institutions need to know, they have to have their expectations right. And I think at the moment, you know, you end up with these very confused expectations because we're blurring different sorts of missions in institutions called universities.
Craig?
I just wanted to pick up on that point because I 100% agree with you. It seems to be that what you're calling for, in a sense, is returning to the pre-94 mm-hmm. situation in the UK. Certainly, I know from a Scottish perspective. That many of these technological colleges, when they became universities, all of a sudden start offering the types of subjects that you'd expect at university, but they do it at a very substandard level. But they offer the things that they used to at technological colleges at an excellent level. So Dundee, which is where I'm from, in Scotland, you have Aberdeen University, which was the old technological college, probably the best place to do computing in Europe, but off all of you want to do history. But the old Dundee University, which was part of the ancient kind of system, has reacted to that by then offering the sorts of courses you'd get at technological colleges, as well as the things they do well in terms of an old university system, but they do the technological side very badly.
Yeah.
So it's how do you get back to the system where they're divided? And I just want to say the Scottish Funding Council actually tried to divide those two universities recently and get them back to the system they were on, and there was such resistance from universities and the students that they were unable to go back to the...
Well, this is the... I mean, I think there's a real... To be honest with you, I think this is a real public relations nightmare in a sense, because university is still kind of the gold standard term, right? And if something's not a university, they're somehow seen as demoted in some way. I mean, of course, in the 19th century, when the polytechnic systems got established across Europe, the polytechnics were seen as very excellent places, doing technological stuff that the established universities wouldn't touch. I mean, that was, you know, so there was no problem when they got started. But I do think this amalgamation, you know, and I don't know, you know, it'd be interesting. It would be an interesting historical project. Whose idea was it to think that all institutions of higher education need to somehow progress to become universities? I don't know whose idea that was. But someone came up with that kind of historical narrative, because that was part of what sold it, right? That there was a sense in which the technological places were incomplete, right? Because they didn't have all these additional subjects that would make them proper universities, and somehow they have to become proper universities. I mean, but once that move was made, you're right. It's really difficult to go back. But that's where I think, this is where I think policymakers in higher education need to kind of think creatively about this, to kind of somehow rebrand those places. Because you can't treat them all as universities, because you're going to end up with exactly what you've just said, where there's a kind of wasteful duplication of effort, essentially, right, in a system that is pretty cash-strapped to begin with. You know, and so it's irrational what's happening, but no, I agree. It's not going to be easy from a public relations standpoint, but you know, I mean, one of the problems I'll tell you one of the well, you may know this that the, one of the things that the UK government's been doing is it's floated proposals to actually create new vocational training colleges, a whole new species of some, you know, as if this is going to solve the, you know, this is, you might say this is kind of a polite way, as it were, to reintroduce the distinction, except now create whole new institutions. If that's the logic, the only thing I can imagine working this, how this could work economically, would be if some of the old polytechnics just disappear and close down, and then these new things replace them. Maybe that's kind of what the government has in the back of its mind. Right, but the whole idea of taking a system that's already quite large, pretty large already, and then adding new institutions just so you can avoid having to tell the old ones that they're now polytechnics seems completely bonkers, unless you expect some of those older institutions to die. You know, and that may be what happens.
Yeah, I find this this whole topic quite interesting as well, because I'm from South Africa.
Uh-huh.
And there we used to have the technical colleges as well. And because of the status of universities, they have also been named universities. Because everyone wants to go to a university, obviously. And it has caused massive confusion with regards to what the role of a university should be.
Yeah.
And a lot of disciplines that are really training people for vocations are now also expected to do certain kinds of research that they're not... that they're not really capable of achieving. So there is quite a big debate going on in South Africa at the moment about classifying different universities as either research intensive or as teaching intensive. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's also
yes.
common in Europe.
Well, we now have in Britain, we have what are called professorships, which are the kind of research-led kind of things that traditionally universities have, but we now have also teaching professorships, okay, that you can become a professor just on the basis of teaching. There are no research obligations, but typically your teaching load is increased by about 50%, and you probably have more administrative duties within the university.
Yeah.
So we've got that going on.
That's just kind of problematic in a sense, because it almost goes against the original
yes.
goal of the university, right?
Yes.
The whole point is to integrate the the research and the teaching.
Yes. Of course. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, but then again, I think that, you know, when people like Humboldt were conceptualizing the modern university, I don't think they quite imagined that everything was going to turn into a university, okay? I think that there was an issue there. And I do think the massification stuff, because one of the arguments that gets made for actually doing things this way is that, and again, this is part of the, you know, if you know something about the history of organizations, okay, there is this kind of narrative that often gets told that as organizations scale up and become more complex, their functions become more differentiated. And this also applies for universities. And so, as a result, the teaching and research function may have worked fine for Humboldt when they were small universities, but when you get into this period now, we need to differentiate all the functions. Okay? And there is a kind of organizational logic that supports this. And so it's not surprising, and of course, if you look at the people who get selected to run universities, they are people who take that kind of organizational logic for granted. So they see the whole idea of the academic as this, you know, teacher researcher person, as kind of a quaint, old fashioned idea that just goes from the days when universities were much smaller, right? So they accept massification as just given. And that if you're living in a massive, if you're running a massified institution, you need a kind of organizational logic that matches that. And I think that's what's driving this kind of differentiation. But of course, what that does is it does kill the university. You're absolutely right. And that's why there is an interesting question about whether there's some kind of optimal size for universities, you know, in terms of what they can do to enable the academic role to retain its integrity. Right? Because after a while, academics just become line managers. I mean, you know. Just like they would be in a corporation.
Well, I was thinking about also the Humboldt model, mm-hmm. which is, the difference is, of course, that the Humboldt model is connected to the state.
Yes.
And also a very strong state.
Yes.
It was the production of civil servants and so on.
Yeah.
And I was wondering now, when we have this really more American context, when people choose their university for their own sake, rather than in some sense being chosen by the university for in-house training of the state.
Mm-hmm.
Can a Humboldt model really cope with this kind of market system of students?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I think that... I think it's tricky. I think it's... But you put your finger on something very important about what made the Humboldt model work. I mean... You know, Prussia, at the time we're talking about in the early 19th century, is basically an aspirational country. It isn't the Germany that we know about at the end of the 19th, early 20th century that's the great intellectual leader of the world. When Humboldt's proposing this idea, it's as a way of really putting Prussia on the world stage in a serious manner to make it competitive with France and England and all these other places. And so this is the not only was the university protected by the state, but the university was being used by the state as a nation building activity, right? And so it wasn't just the civil servants. I mean, Humboldt actually did imagine that, you know, business people and so forth would go to university, right? And all of this would be in the way of enhancing and empowering the state. And in fact, the reason why philosophy was the foundational discipline for this, and the way that the German idealists did it, was because, you know, philosophy was, as it were, the kind of abstract foundation of citizenship, right? How do you need to think about yourself as a human being? How do you think about your freedom? How do you think about, you know, all these metaphysical things about yourself, right? And why? Well, because the state ultimately becomes this kind of world, as it were, that you're being trained to be into. And Hegel, it's very clear in Hegel, this is what he's talking about, right? And this is where Hegel's very much the philosopher of that kind of university. But you're right, as soon as the state loses its significance, I mean, obviously the state is still funding universities, but the state no longer has this kind of ideological command over people, right? So the idea of being a citizen of a country, right, as being kind of, maybe your first form of identity, that doesn't exist anymore. But that was part of what was the Humboldtian thing, right? In a sense... this is training for citizenship at the end of the day. And that's why liberal arts was so important, right? Because in a sense, you are training this kind of person living in this kind of society. Now, you got there, you know, in the world we live in, there are a couple of options. One, of course, would be to try to revive the state, right? I mean, that would be one way to get Humboldt back on the table, would be to have some kind of state ideology, okay? I think it's difficult, but I don't think we should put that off the table. I actually think that a lot of countries outside of Europe that are trying to build themselves up in the world, I think, use their universities in kind of this way, though they don't necessarily have the kind of liberal arts foundation for the university that Humboldt was pushing. But nevertheless, I do think, you know, if you go to Asia and, you know, places like this, I do think there is an effort actually to use the universities for nation building. The other thing, of course, would be to think about the university as a place for building global citizenship, some kind of cosmopolitan citizenship, you know? And I think that kind of fits. I think that kind of a role would be very good for universities that are already in the business of internationalizing, you know, where in a sense that, you know, you see the writing on the wall, you see more and more of your students are coming from overseas. You know, how are you dealing with those students? Are they just cash cows, or is there something you can, as it were, ideologically capitalize on having this kind of diverse student body? Well, one of the things you might say is, well, that diversity provides a pretext for thinking about a globalized conception of liberal education, a person who's able to live in the world, right? Not just in this country, not only the country you come from, but can live in the world. Again, I think that would take some ingenuity, some creativity. But I think if you look at the demographics of people, especially coming to the more prominent universities, the internationalization could be used to that kind of advantage. I guess that so those are two things, you know, that I would. But again, all of this requires leadership, right? It requires some thinking from the top. It can't just be in response mode. Because as you were pointing out in your question, the kind of market environment in which we live provides no direct incentive for any of this. You got to kind of think a little bit ahead of the curve to really see the value of this. Because the market environment basically just keeps you in a kind of state of endless adaptation to new situations. So what you know, and the logic of that is you just end up creating these indefinitely flexible institutions where nobody's there for very long, departments aren't around for very long, things are, you know, the furniture is constantly being rearranged. Right? People are shifted from one building to another and put into new locations. I mean, you know, that's the lot. That's where you end up if you just operate in response mode as a university.
A comment to that, I mean, what's happened with the polytechnics being transformed to universities and so on. I mean, this is a region building activity.
Oh.
Which makes some of these institutions very parochial.
Oh, I was going to say something about that. That's a very good point because are you guys familiar with this guy Richard Florida?
Yeah.
Okay, right. Richard Florida is the man, right?
He's the man.
You know, it's so funny because the first time I ever found out about this guy was in this country. No, Sweden is
very popular.
I know. No,
can
you know,
say
he's
something
this,
more about.
Okay, Richard Florida is this American economist, he writes about what he calls the creative class. Okay, and so you know the thing that he notices about you know we're creative. He notices a couple of things about creative people. First of all, they spend a lot of money. Okay, and then the question is, where do they hang out? And university towns are the great places to hang out. And so, you know, there, if you follow the logic of his argument, there's a sense in which, you know, it's you know, you could use you can build universities in places that you want to use as basis for regional development, because they're attractors, right? They attract people who spend money. Right, you guys basically, right, academics and so forth, and that attracts business, right, and so you know this is a kind of an and it doesn't matter and the point is right it doesn't matter how good the university is. This is the key point, right? It is unrelated to the quality of the university. It just has to do with what is provided by the university environment. And he talks about it at some point as being a bit like casino capitalism. right? In the sense that people come to university towns to realize their dreams. And they spend a lot of money, you know, being students for 10 years, thinking they're going to, you know, hang out in coffee bars and bookshops and go to movies a lot and, you know, spend lots of money, right? Whatever little money they have. Nothing much may happen as a result, but there's a lot of money pumped into the economy in the process. And this helps everyone, you see? It doesn't matter whether these students ever go anywhere or do anything. Right? And so he recommends this as a kind of urban and regional development policy. yeah.
It's followed strictly in Sweden. 10 years in. Yeah. Linnea, please.
I have a question about something we talked about earlier. If the purpose for the academic education should be that of self-exploration, and if the students should not enter the universities with expectations of getting a job afterwards, wouldn't this lead to an exclusion of those students who simply can't afford an education if it does not improve their chances of getting a job?
Well, I mean, it's interesting you mention that. This is certainly what it would look like, except that if you look at the Ivy League universities, which charge more money than any universities in the world, right? Because of this generous alumni system that they've developed, in fact, 2/3 of the students who go to these universities are either partially or fully subsidized in terms of the tuition fees, okay? So they have to do well in exams to get into the universities, but they don't actually have to pay necessarily the whole thing. There's a lot of, you know, so in other words, you can actually go to these very, you know, kind of high standard places without having to spend a lot of money. I mean, I come from a poor background. And that's exactly what happened to me. I went to Columbia University on a full scholarship, okay? And I come from a poor background, and I didn't have to worry about, you know, thinking about, you know, what degree to get in order to get a job and all that, because I was completely subsidized. And that's, and that does happen. I mean, if you look at, so when you look at all these American universities that charge so much money, the thing to look at is how many students are actually paying the tuition fee, because most of them are subsidized. Okay? Now, I don't know, I don't think that solves the whole problem. I don't think it solves everything you're talking about at all. But I do think that there is that aspect of the situation, right? That one of the benefits of having a self-funding wealthy university is that historically those universities have actually tried to deal with this class problem, right? You know, by actually incorporating a lot of people from poor backgrounds. They have done that. You know, it's just that there are not enough of them around and they only can take care of so many people. Okay, but that would be one way to go on that, you know. But of course, you know, this would be a great thing for, you know, if you want to talk about where the state should continue to have a role in funding higher education, it should be on this point, right? Namely, that you know, that for poor people, right? That if they do well on some kind of entrance examination or something, they should just be allowed entry without, you know, so they don't have to think about whether they're going to be, you know, having to pay. I mean, Britain, let me give you an example. Britain actually has a very interesting system, which people criticize a lot, but in a way, partly addresses your problem. In Britain, now there's £9,000 tuition fee in Britain, and it tripled, like, overnight, right, under the current government. But the way in which it's administered, it's not that the student has to pay £9,000 up front. In fact, what happens is the government pays the £9,000 on behalf of the student, and then the student pays it back once their income after graduation reaches some threshold of £20,000 or something like that. Okay? So in other words, if you're not making a lot of money, you don't pay it back. Now, this system is highly criticized because people don't expect the students are going to make that much money to be able to pay back the loans. And so the government's going to go bankrupt over this. And so it's probably going to be stopped. But that's actually, you see, that, you know, even though it was really criticized when it got implemented because, you know, because it was part of this raising of tuition to £9,000, which everybody found abhorrent, nevertheless, that way of how you pay back actually, in the short, you know, in terms of students worrying about being able to pay back tuition, that actually takes care of the problem, because you don't pay back unless you reach a certain income level. It's just it might not be financially viable. That's the problem. The system might not be financially viable because not enough students graduating are making £20,000. You know, so Britain has this wonderful low unemployment rate at the moment. Well, look at the average salaries of those people. Yeah, we have very low unemployment with people making nothing. That's basically what the situation is. So this ends up bankrupting a system that in principle could address your question, actually.
Craig.
I just wanted to make a couple of comments on that, because I think one of the issues, though, is that you could be earning just above the threshold, which a lot of people do, and you're paying back the same level of debt as somebody who's earning, you know, 100 times
that's true.
What you're earning.
That's true.
And whilst the American system is almost like a voluntary loan system, I suppose, and as far as the alumni fund, if you're earning $1 million a year, you're far more likely to get back significantly more than someone who's earning, you know, far less than you. So, in some ways, I quite like the American system. I just also want to say, as far as I understand, in the US they have a blind application as well,
yes,
which I think is really, really good as well. So basically the universities don't know who you are when you apply, so they don't know whether or not they will have to give you a scholarship or not,
yes,
which I think is great. My point, though, was on the thing you raised earlier about autonomous universities. And in the US, it seems to work really well because of this tradition of alumni contributions. Do you ever envisage such a system being able to be introduced into the UK where you could actually get this tradition running? And secondly, you know, because it seems to me where there has been experiments on like autonomous universities, the fees that they charge students are just absolutely incredible. That you know, only the mega wealthy could actually go to these universities. So how do we get to that stage of autonomy?
No, it's a good question. I mean, our university, my university, Warwick, is one of these places that does toy with the idea of going autonomous, okay? I mean, I think the way it is, because one of the things about a place like mine is that less than 25% of the income actually comes from the state these days. Because, you know, as part of the neoliberal logic, right, you have all this public accountability, but the state is constantly encouraging you to get money from the outside. So it ends up you're actually not getting that much from the state, so you're getting to a point where it's getting quite minor. So places like mine start to think about, okay, how much would it cost to pull out? And the way we've been experimenting with that has been through the business school. Warwick was founded with this enormous business school. If you know something about the history of my university, you'll know that it was very controversial when it was started, because basically the business school is allowed to just, you know, generate all kinds of money, and then it gets used to subsidize the rest of the university. That's kind of the historic model. Well, so the point is Warwick Business School has a lot of very wealthy alumni at this point in history, 50 years down the line. And so the thinking is to actually hit up those guys. So in other words, not try, you know, hit up the Warwick Business School and then redistribute the funds, right, to keep the university afloat. It's working marginally. You really need a lot. I mean, this is the thing. You actually, you know, if you're looking at a place like Harvard, okay, Harvard was founded in the early 17th century. Okay, age of university matters. This is one thing, by the way, it's very hard to be a top-notch university if you're not at least 100 or 200 years old. and that's largely because of the stream of people who have come through, right? But that's kind of what we're trying. We're trying, and I think the universities in Britain that have been trying to go down this route have started with the business school, because the business schools of the universities are usually the places you can hit up for rich alumni, you know, who might be inclined to do this. Because people who graduate from business schools, I don't know if it's true in this country, but certainly true in Britain, often they have a bit of a chip on their shoulder about not being intellectual enough. So they actually like the idea of contributing to the university the business school is attached to as a way of kind of raising, you know, their own kind of kudos, right? So, you know, and so I think you could sometimes guilt trip the business school graduates into helping universities. You know, so I you know, again, I don't think that's a foolproof plan. I don't know if you remember this, but in the UK, let's see, when would it have been? It would have been maybe 15 years ago, when William Hague was the leader of the Conservative Party. he's now the foreign secretary in the UK. He put forward this idea of the state providing endowments to universities. I don't know if you recall this. You may have been too young to remember. The idea was that the state would actually, you know, so rather than continuing to subsidize universities indefinitely in the way the UK still does to varying degrees, depending on what university you're talking about, the government would just provide a kind of lump endowment that would be a kind of capital investment that the university then would be in charge of investing and doing whatever it will to keep itself afloat. Okay? And that idea was talked about for a while. Now, you see, that would be one way. You know, people didn't like that because it amounted to kind of this, you know, it would be like kind of privatizing National Health Service. This is how people thought about it, right? They would be privatizing higher education in a really radical kind of way by selling it off, right? Universities would get this endowment and then they just go off and do stuff with it. But that might actually work. The point is, you know, if you can get away from the public relations problem that it would cause by depublicizing in a strict way, that could work, you know.
That was actually discussed in Sweden in connection with the autonomous thing, and it was way too expensive.
You have
to donate 500 billion
pounds
or something like that to keep Uppsala University afloat. So it was impossible.
That's a good point, because I mean, I think whenever we talk about these discussions about autonomous universities in the UK, we're never thinking about Oxford and Cambridge.
No.
Because Oxford and Cambridge are the most heavily subsidized universities that you can imagine. Okay, I mean, Oxford and Cambridge, which still has a kind of, you know, one-to-one, one-to-two tutorial system alongside of its lectures and all the rest of it, actually employs enormous numbers of people in those colleges. It's like mini welfare states, those universities. All kinds of hangers-on, right? All these tutors. If you've been to Oxford and Cambridge, you know what I mean, right? There are these people who don't really have formal department status, but they're the ones who do the tutoring to all the kids. Okay? And so it's enormous numbers of employees, and it's subsidized by the state to a massive extent. So that, in fact, it was estimated that if Oxford pulled out, its tuition fee would be twice Harvard's. Okay? So when we talk about autonomous universities, you're usually not, you can't be really be talking about ones. See, this is the thing, probably the problem with Uppsala is old, established, there's so much wealth from all of this land and stuff you've got. You see, all that kind of stuff makes it very difficult to go autonomous. I mean, it would have to be kind of a newer, leaner kind of university to really make it a kind of, you know, viable proposition. Yeah, but no, Oxford and Cambridge could not compete with Harvard on a level playing field. No. I mean, give you a sense, okay? Harvard's endowment, right, is actually seven times that of Oxford and Cambridge together. And the question I always ask is, why isn't Harvard better? Right? No, seriously, you think about it. Think about it, guys. Think about it. No, I do think, the interesting thing about, when people, I mean, this is a parenthetical point, but I think it's always worth thinking about, that I do think that if you're talking about efficient expenditure of funding in higher education, Europe has it all over America. America is a place awash with money. The most mediocre places have paid PhD fellowships for anyone, okay? And you would expect that actually the university system was a bit better than it really is, considering the difference in the amount of money that's spent on it. I mean, that's the thing. Europe really gets by on relatively little by American standards. You know, and that's why those neoliberals always feel they can always tighten the screws a bit more, because they know just how efficiency minded we are.
Are we done?
On that happy note, yes.
Yeah, maybe we are. I think we should give Steve.
Okay.